Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tinsberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, my guest is the wonderful Jim Crusoe. Jim is the author of 5 novels, a couple books of short stories. He is probably one of the 2 or 3 most prominent creative writing teachers in Los Angeles, and his new book has just come out. It's called Parsifal. Now, I immediately got worried. Do I have to know who Parsifal is, and who is Parsifal?
Well, simultaneously, Michael, it's best you not know. And so I shouldn't tell you, but I will.
Okay.
Okay, Parsifal is, really it's an old story, and there's several versions of it. One is the original poem, I think, is by Wolfram von Eschenbach, a German writer. And it's about, essentially, and then there's Percival, and there's other ones. Essentially, the story—
Don't mix me up.
Essentially, it's about a young boy who was raised by his mother in the forest and then has to enter the world of knighthood is what it amounts to. And, of course, there's the Wagner opera, which was important to me when I wrote it. But if I'm not mistaken, in The Legends of Arthur, Parsifal's father is Lancelot.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
So
is his mother Guinevere? Is
no.
He, no.
No, it's some other chick.
Uh-huh.
But I like the idea that there isn't one story, that it's a kind of a palimpsest of one story laid upon another story. And so upon all of those, I've laid my own. And you don't really have to know what it is.
Now,
that's it.
You've said that this is your most autobiographical novel. Now, how could that be possibly true? How could that possibly be true?
Well, it's possible in 3 ways, Michael, and they're kind of head-spinning in a way. The first and the silliest way is that Parsifal's job is repairing fountain pens, and I love fountain pens. I write with fountain pens. I break fountain pens, but I don't usually repair them. But that's what Parsifal does. And then there's other odd, I guess I'd call them coincidences in my life that seem to have happened to Parsifal. Once when I was in the army, I burned a tent down trying to keep warm. And Parsifal does the same, alas, with a preschool. So there are little angles of incidents between the two of our lives, Parsifal's and mine, all the way through this book. Then, in a more serious way, Parsifal was raised in the forest. In other words, he really was a wild child in some ways. He had no clue on what to do or how to behave. And I was raised in Cleveland, which is called the Forest City.
The Forest City.
It is. And both of my parents happened to be immigrants. My father went to the 3rd grade, and that was it. So in a sense, I was raised as well without any clue how to behave in the world. I mean, I had kind of an isolated way to behave. But once I left Cleveland, it was a very, very big world. And then thirdly, and more interestingly and disturbingly, maybe this happens to you too, but as I get older, a lot of the things that I thought happened to me, I learned that I actually had provoked in some way.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the big revelation, and the painful and mortifying one, and the humbling one. And that actually was, in a perverse way, the great pleasure of this sort of exploration.
I see exactly what you mean. In my life, it's discovering that I did it to myself, no mm-hmm. matter what it was,
mm-hmm.
and that in order to rectify it, I'm going to have to make some essential change in myself. Is there that part of it, too?
Well, actually, the question, not only of this book, but my previous one, is it possible to rectify it?
Uh-huh.
And I honestly, the jury's out on that one. I don't know that it's possible. I think Parsifal, the character here, does a better job with that question than in the previous book.
I see. Well, I noticed that Parsifal, this fountain pen repairer by profession, is like several of your previous heroes, incompetent and kind of foolish. But how is he different? What's the special thing about Parsifal?
All my heroes, in some way, and are like children. And in that sense, they're incompetent but hopeful. And how is he different? He's different in the sense that I think he more actively pursues his quest, and in a certain way, he comes to terms in the end with what he's looking for, which happens to be a peculiar metal drinking cup that his father gave him when he was living in the forest, and the cup has the mysterious name of Fendula.
Well, you can't fool me, right? Now, this guy with his fountain pen business, he repairs broken lances? Is that the...
Oh, you know what? I hadn't thought that.
Oh, I thought that right away.
You
I thought
just
he
fooled
held it.
Me.
Yes. And, you know, that cup that he's looking for, metal or otherwise, is, I think, has another name.
Does it start with G?
Yes, the Holy Grail.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so, like, to what extent? This book is set in America and more or less now. And it used to be people would write things based upon the Grail legend. The Wasteland is based upon the Grail legend. You're doing something different. It's, first of all, much funnier. And
funnier
it's...
than the Wasteland?
Well,
how
Jim,
could that be, Michael?
I know, I yeah. know, I know. The Shakespearean rag is pretty funny.
Yeah.
And, well, it's funnier in intention. You use parody, too, Eliot does. But it's almost as if in that he's bemoaning a world that can't be reconstituted anymore. This world, your world, has sunk so low already that all that it's capable of is more foolishness and bedevilment.
Exactly, and that's why he's looking for the cup that is not the Grail in the sense that it's going to solve problems, but the cup is the one symbol, I suppose, of the way life used to be when he was a child, when that moment that many people have doesn't last long. When you're a kid and for a second the world seems to be working the way it's supposed to. And someone once told me that, I've always been really profoundly moved by this, is that all anyone is trying to do is in their whole lives is to get back to that one moment when everything was exactly right.
Is there any such moment? I mean, can you think back to
I know exactly when it was.
And, tell me.
And it was when I was maybe 2 years old, maybe 1 year old, and I can remember sitting on the bed next to my mom, holding my teddy bear, whose name was Teddy, and that was the moment when everything was in its place, you know, and I think that's it's memorialized somewhere by a picture, so that maybe it's make it a little suspect, but that's the moment, and then it never really got together after that. So this cup, this Fendula thing, which is deliberately impossible to place, is that thing that he's really looking for.
So he goes on a quest to the forest where he grew up to look for this cup. And what does he find instead?
Well, he finds deprivation. He finds a broken ankle, and he finds Misty, the sort of elusive woman figure of his life, maybe a substitute for the mom in that sense. But he finds her along with two guys.
Dudes,
indeed.
Two dudes.
Yeah.
And they're all stoned.
Yes.
And they're all in the forest, and they treat Parsifal sort of like they've found, I don't know, a raccoon or something. You know, they'll give him a bit of
food.
They'll, you know, their energy bars if they've got some extras. But they don't. They don't help exactly. And I wondered if help was possible in the world you're describing.
Help's never possible in a quest. Or maybe it is possible in a quest. But no, they don't. He's got to do this totally without help. And in fact, that probably determines the ending as well.
I'm talking with Jim Crusoe. He's the author of Parsifal. Now, tell me, it seems to be this quest hilariously scuttled by the fact that when looking for the forest, he asks the blind people. And when the blind person answers, he answers as if he were hard of hearing. Parsifal asks for the forest, but the blind person directs him to the forest.
Yeah.
Well, what's that?
Well, that's a sort of a misdirection, and I suppose it prefigures that this quest may be with some difficulties. But yes, he goes to the florist. He buys a couple roses, tulips, that he's going to bring back to Misty, and manages to lose them before he gets back home again. So he's not so competent. Parsifal is not. But
he tries. He's not the bravest of the knights. And he seems to be, by now, the only of the knights we hear about. You know, this is Parsifal going all the way back to the Round Table. Have they all been dispersed and destroyed, and this is the only one left, do you think?
That's a good question. I suppose it's the only one that counts. Maybe in, I'm fond, as my students are fond of saying, in this day and age, knights that slay things are not real knights. The real knights are the only knights, are the ones that are in search of something.
Yeah. And, well, it also struck me that he's sort of like, well, the simple son in the fairy tales, that rather than getting a big, brawny, brave knight, we get Sanctus Simplicissimus, the blessed fool.
Mm-hmm.
And that if there is going to be anything we're led to, it's going to be because foolishness rather than fierce aggression is going to come to our service.
We had better hope so, because maybe foolishness, as you know, is all that's left.
Do you find foolishness, your own foolishness, to be helpful?
I love my own foolishness. It's the one moment that I'm free. You see, because when you don't know something, well, when I don't know something, then I can go in any direction. The minute that I think I know something, my world is constrained. My world is shut down. And at that point, I'm not a free agent. But those moments, you know, the moment where I drive my wife crazy because I like getting lost. Because the moment you're lost, you're free.
Well, I agree. I tend to agree with that. That is to say, when people want a straight answer from me, I tend to speak nonsense. And this works so well that I've taught other people to do it too. Now, what happens, as they used to say, when everyone starts acting silly?
We can only wait. I mean, I don't know. It might be a really wonderful world. Do you know that? I hadn't thought of that vision of everybody bumping into each other. Why not?
Yeah. Now, Parsifal is, I think, if not an autobiographical novel, an allegorical novel, in that in this book there's a war between the earth and the sky. And the sky is hurling down appliances to crush humans with.
Well, it doesn't have to hurl them. They just fall, Michael. but yes, it is doing that.
The sky is just, what, washing machines and cars and axles and all kinds of things are raining from the sky.
Exactly right.
And
paper clips sometimes.
Sometimes, and they sparkle in the light. They sparkle like a small constellation. Mm-hmm. Parsifal sees it at night, glittering. Mm-hmm. And the Earth is retaliating by...
Combusting, I suppose, by forest fires and volcanoes and things like that, and filling the atmosphere with smoke, in other words.
So between the Earth and the sky, there's no safety zone.
That's right. And that was interesting to me because, I mean, first of all, there is the allegorical idea that there's something profoundly wrong with the environment, that something is clearly off balance. But then going back to this funny autobiography that I've written, someone told me, and again, I wrote it without thinking about it, that for a lot of people, the sky is the father and the earth is the mother. And I was raised in an atmosphere in Cleveland, in the forest, where my whole life they argued. That my whole life there was just this constant yelling back and forth between the two of them. They weren't happy together. So in a sense, they're the background to my hero. They're the background to who I am.
Wow. So the earth and the sky fighting are mom and dad and... Parsifal, in this version, doesn't have a child. He has someone that he hopes will be his girlfriend because he's successfully repaired her fountain pen.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Misty, and she, when we meet her subsequently, is almost always stoned.
Yes, it's Misty.
Yeah. But it brings up that girl in that song. Well, isn't there I Feel Misty or something?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And there is a whole feeling for American song and American loneliness and country and Western song in this book. If the hero is derived from the knights, he's further derived from our only descendant of the knights, the cowboys. And he hears his mother singing a song to him from his childhood in the forest. What song is that?
Oh, you're right. And you're right to pick the loneliness of it because Parsifal is lonely. I mean, he's by himself in the world. And the song is not cowboy, but country and Western. It's Hank Williams' brilliant and wonderful song, I'm So Lonesome I Can Cry, which... becomes, as a lot of things in this book, becomes a refrain. And the lines are, the silence of a falling star lights up a purple sky. And as I wonder where you are, I'm so lonesome, I could cry. I have to say that line, the silence of a falling star lighting up the sky, has always killed me. I've always thought it was beyond brilliant, that particular image.
And I would say that song, when we hear it, breaks the spell. The spell is of magic realism turned into a kind of comic book, into a kind of cartoon. But when we hear that song, I'm feeling so lonesome I could cry, we understand that this whole mood, this crazy, lonely, silly, melancholic mood is based on loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
And he's gone on a quest because he's been living by himself and he's so lonely. He needs to go out into the world, as eventually it seems to me that the older you get and the lonelier you are, the more you need to and the less equipped you are to combat anything you might find out in the world.
I mean, not only is Parsifal lonely, but it feels increasingly that the human race is lonely in the world. We've alienated ourselves in so many different ways. And this book is not about preaching. This book is not, a diatribe. But it is sad that we have left the world so far behind, all of us.
I'm talking with Jim Crusoe. the author of Parsifal. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Jim Crusoe about his new book, Parsifal. It's one man's funny and mythic quest through the wilds of his childhood, leading to a kind of profound loneliness and sadness.
It's about lonesomeness and, I suppose, the recognition of lonesomeness. And then there's this funny thing. I don't know that it happens to everyone who reads the book. To me, it's a sad book as well. But there is something about the recognition of lonesomeness that also is enlightened. I mean, that understanding comes in the end. And it may not be the understanding that Parsifal wanted at the beginning, but it is an understanding. And, gee, that seems so much better than not.
I think that he's one of those folk who are going to do a lot better not trying to rectify, which is what a knight usually does to set right, but to feel the deepness of responsibility, which is a version of sadness. And in a sense, I would disagree with you. I'd say that this is a preaching book in that what he learns is that his sadness is his responsibility to a world that he doesn't know how to save anymore. And his announcement is that we're all knights, all of us, who've forgotten how to save the world.
Well, I would be really happy if people got that from the book, although I didn't write it for a second with that as an intention.
Well, good for you, Jim Crusoe. Who's your favorite writer living in the world today?
Oh, he's practically the opposite. When you're talking about salvation, it's the wonderful Hungarian novelist László Krasznahorkai, who has been writing this Eastern European bleakness that is both that kind of veers between suicidal bleakness and hilarious bleakness for several years now. And he's wonderful.
Well, Jim, I have a surprise for you, because László Krasznahorkai is coming to America. He hasn't been here all that frequently, only two or three times. And we're going to get to talk to him together on the program. To listeners, Krasznahorkai is doubly extraordinary, not only because of these novels, but because he's written with Béláthár, the great Hungarian world master filmmaker, one of the two or three living legends of world cinema. They've written the last five movies together, and his book, Satan Tango, which was the basis of an incredible seven-hour movie, has been translated into English, and we'll be talking about that. Have you seen Satan Tango?
I have, and it's a fabulous film. It's it actually, and it's interesting because in some ways, I suppose, in the end, it brings one back to that same kind of deep and profound, not relaxation, but acceptance.
And the sense that there's nowhere to go in the world.
That's right.
All we have is one another, and we're not very good to each other, and we haven't taught our children to be very good to each other. And so you watch this movie, and you say it's about the attempt to forge a community, but out of people who are used to tricking and stealing from one another. These are, in a way, both this movie, Satan Tango, and your novel, Parsifal, stories about having worked the world so hard, so brutally, that it becomes your enemy, and so do the people in it. What's adorable about your work, by which I mean what can be adored about the work, is that it's seen that this has rendered men and women into children and fools and babies. And maybe, 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 starting over again from that lack of knowledge, we can make a start toward a quest toward something of a better world, huh?
Well, the other hasn't worked so well, has it? So starting out with what we know doesn't necessarily hasn't necessarily produced anything except a profound disjunction in between us and the world.
So do you think really that writing novels to convince people to surrender their vast insistence on authority and power, are we going to get anywhere better or just have some nice novels to read?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't write novels to do anything except to explore a question. And I'm not trying to convince anybody to do anything. I'm trying to see where it takes me. So the novel here was set up kind of differently than most novels. It's set up without a narrative. It's set up in pieces. And it's like putting out pieces on a stage. And the pieces involve a world where something is profoundly wrong, i.e. things are falling from the sky. There is a quest. And Parzival himself is a monster. He finds himself completely alienated from the world from the get-go almost. So that's the stage in a way. That's the situation. And I wasn't trying to convince anyone of anything. I'm saying given that world, where can it go?
I've been talking with Jim Crusoe, author most recently of Parzival, published by Tin House Books. Thank you, Jim, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael. It was fun.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Parzival at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Connie Alvarez is my co-producer. Harriet Ells has sat in for her today. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Craigor Thine. Join us next week when Jim Crusoe and I will talk with the great Hungarian novelist László Krasznahorkai. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.